Well, the beautiful and haunting sounds of the viola da gamba, and believe it or not, just one there, multiple versions of the one player, Liam Byrne, and it's from Long Phrases for the Wilton Diptych by composer Nico Muhly. You're hearing it here on The Music Show. I'm Julian Day, sitting in for Andrew Ford, and I have the composer sitting opposite me right now. Nico, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about what we've just been hearing. I get the sense that the experience of coming across this artwork is something that many of us are familiar with. You drop into a new city, in this case London, you wander through one of the big galleries and you're suddenly arrested by a particular artwork. And this one is a very unusual piece.
Right. So it's a late 14th century miniature portable altar. And there are four panels. It's a double diptych. And it's just the most beautiful thing in the universe. It's tiny. It's the size of, basically the size of two pieces of paper, and enclosed in this wooden box. And the National Gallery asked if I would like to compose a response to, as an installation, one piece in their collection. And they were sort of pushing me towards impressionist works. And I said, the only way I will do it is if it's the Wilton Diptych. So they moved it downstairs into this darkened room. And I thought, well, what I have to do, because it's actually not a piece of art. It's a worship item, right? It's a sacred object, which of course is imbued with the political, as all things at that time were. But I thought, okay, what I've got to do is surround it with, you know, 12 of a similar instrument kind of rotating through the surround sound. That was how I came up with the idea of using multiple violas da gamba.
It's also quite lavish. I mean, look at it, it's sort of dripping with gold. And I think that double image is the thing that you most notice about it. Like, there are two panels that you look at it from one side, and then you walk around, it's like a whole other artwork.
Then there's the stag with his, the most unbelievably elegant crossed fingers. And for me, you know, I worked a lot at the English National Opera just up the road, and when I would take lunch breaks and just sit there and look at it as a sort of meditative practice. But of course, you know, you have millions of tourists around. So for me, the gift of just even the time that I was alone with it at 6 o'clock in the morning after they moved it was so special, you know, very emotional, but also incredibly private.
I'm intrigued by how much you take inspiration from older work. You are, in one sense, the quintessential 21st century composer. You're adept at electronics. There are, in fact, electronic moments throughout that work. You work with pop stars of the likes of Björk and Grizzly Bear. You've worked for film and television. And yet, it seems like older music, and in particular Renaissance music, really speaks to you as a composer.
That's very true, and I think it's just because most of my formative musical experiences were, in addition to being a sort of kid pianist, as most of us at some point were, I was in an Anglican boys choir, and that was and that tradition is so removed from the main threads of classical music pedagogy, right? So you're not really made to study Byrd or Tallis or Tye or Gibbons or Taverner, either Taverner for that matter. And so for me, I always felt like I had this slightly different musical genealogy, and that's something that I have yet to escape from. And for me, that's kind of the most important touch point for all the work that I do. And I still think about that music every day, and I still listen to that music every day, recreationally, or, you know, just score study for fun.
And I guess once you're immersed in that, it never really leaves you. I'm thinking back to my first year of studying music as an undergraduate. I was just a chorus member in a Benjamin Britten opera, and I think I can...
Which one?
That was Billy Budd, actually.
Good, okay, good.
Yeah, and they sort of they carved a ship in half, and right. So you sort of see this cross-section of the above deck with the admirals and so forth, and the below deck with the choir.
For Real, the Rights of Man, yeah. It's...
That's right. I don't think any note of that opera has left me. I can still recall it. It's like once you're deep in a choir, or in the case of this Anglican tradition, it still must be within you somewhere as a composer.
And I think also, you know, it's interesting that you said being a part of a chorus or a choir makes you part of a team. And I think what that does is it sort of diffuses the composer or soloist as the kind of romantic hero. And I think, you know, the experience of being in just in making sacred music is that no one claps, and it happens at weird times of day, right? If it's you know, if it's a Eucharistic service, it's happening at 11 o'clock in the morning. If it's you know, Evensong, it's happening at 4:45, and whatever it is specific for that time of year. So you get this real sense of seasonality and of how special music is, as opposed to, you know, nothing wrong with it, but as opposed to you know, you could walk into a concert hall and chances are you'll hear a Brahms symphony, or chances are, it doesn't matter. It's not like you save Brahms for, you know, the second Sunday after Pentecost or whatever.
Also, I guess you get a sense that in the Renaissance, for instance, composers are there making music for the everyday. The ego is much more removed. And I'm trying to think, is there a kind of a contemporary parallel to that? I guess in one sense, we're in an era where style is all very open. You can write in any style you like. At the same time, I'm thinking back to the Renaissance when composers were working in a common language. And I wonder if you can see any parallels now. I mean, would you say you yourself are working in a common language?
Well, at a certain point, I think the parallels start to become a little forced. I mean, I think you know, you can make an argument that it's egoless, but you can also make an argument that a lot of those composers were kind of, you know, doing a sort of act of one-upsmanship to one another. You know, some of them were, you know, had their predecessor's job, and the predecessor took back over. And, you know, you see this at Westminster Abbey, and you see this about, you know, how florid can the polyphony be before the government says, oh, no, actually, you can't do this. And, you know, it's not as pure as we would like to think, perhaps.
And there was that famous instance of, I have 40 singers for my 40-part motet. Right. Let's do 80. Well, right. I can do 100.
Or in the question of, you know, like, where did that come from? Like, was it just Tallis being what, you know, or did it come from the Strigio 40-part motet? Or, you know, what? There's a lot of, it's a little bit more political and a little bit more, a little bit more tricky than I think it's a sort of lazy shortcut to be like, well, at that time it was such a pure expression of music for use. And, you know, I imagine they were all pretty sassy. And, you know, Thomas Wilkes is like, you know, peeing on the dean from the balcony. And, you know, they were not necessarily unlike us.
More down to earth than we think.
Yeah.
Well, look, there are elements of early music in the sound of this next piece we're going to hear, the opening of Confessions, this album. But the words are from a very contemporary source.
So Confessions is a collaboration between me and the Faroese singer-songwriter Taitur, of whom I had been a fan long before we met. And just at that time, he was a very, very, he still is, but he's an amazingly skilled, basically, songwriter in the classic style, in almost like the Nashville style. It's like he really knows that craft. He can write a tune. The lyrics are popping. You will always remember the tune for the rest of your life. But at that time, he had just released this album called The Singer, which to me was one of the first times I had seen someone with that degree of skill at making, I don't want to say traditional music, but making music that just nails it, really open up into what an arrangement can do. And we got put together by the music center in Eindhoven, the Netherlands, where I was working at the time. And we thought, wouldn't it be amazing to write a collection of songs sort of about YouTube and about internet comments, but use broke instruments to do it. And so the ensemble is a Baroque orchestra. So it's recorders, or one recorder player, strings and harpsichord. Like Jane Fonda. You don't look like Jane Fonda at all. I finally ended up describing you as a movie I saw when I was a child. I think I was 7 or 8 or 6. It was a movie about rural electrification. The movie, it was about farmers living in the country without electricity. They didn't have any appliances and they had to use lanterns. They put poles across the countryside, strung wire over fields and pastures. There was an incredible heroic dimension. The movie showed electricity like a young Greek god coming to take away forever dark ways of life. I
was trying to describe you to someone. You don't look like anyone I've seen before. I couldn't say she looks just like Jane Fonda. I couldn't say her mouth is a little different. You don't look like Jane Fonda at all.
That is the opening of Confessions. It features the Faroese singer Taitua from the Faroe Islands. It's called Describe You, and it's by the composer sitting opposite me here in the RN studios, Nico Muley.
Hello.
Nico, tell me about the instruments we're hearing. The Holland Baroque is the group. There's mm-hmm. a lute in there. Is this an authentic ensemble?
I should say before we go in there, it's actually Taitua and I co-wrote everything. So it's an equal collaboration. I hesitate to take more credit than I should, and all the lyrics are his, and we really layered it on top of one another, which was actually for me an amazing process. To, you know, I'd start with a little ostinato, and then he'd add a melody, and then take this and take that, and add the strings and whatever. So there, it was a real, a true collaboration in the kind of, in the purest sense of the word. But yes, that's Holland Baroque, who are recorder, harpsichord, lute or theorbo in that case, and a bunch of strings, 20 some strings.
And taking all the lyrics from online, so YouTube and so forth, internet also played a big role in your big opera, Two Boys, except instead of being more the common throwaway bits that we might blink and miss, this was more like the darker side of the internet. I guess the reason why I bring this up is that I guess in that opera, you're really drawing on this tradition of using contemporary living and bringing that onto the opera stage.
Yes, although I think to a certain extent with Two Boys, one of the things that we were all, and this is to say the librettist and the conductor and everyone, and the director, is that, you know, using disguise to hear something that we want to hear, or using disguise to get something that we want, either physically or emotional, is as old as theater, right? That's baked into the form since the Greeks, and through opera, and through Così Van Tutte, through Partenope, through you name it. And in a sense, the internet in that case becomes a delivery system for the same drug.
Of course, yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the things that's amazing about any story that you read in which there's internet deceit, it's very much like Così Fan Tutte, where you think, how can they not know? How can these women not know that their husbands have pasted on like Albanian mustaches or that they're fiancés? And how can they not know, right? And you see the same thing with all these internet stories. It's like, how could this football player not know that his online girlfriend was actually just this dude he knew from school? You know, it's, you know, obviously you know, and obviously you don't want to know, because you're hearing the thing that you really want to be, that you really want to hear, which is that you're loved and you're seen or whatever. And then it gets dark, right? And then all of a sudden, then the night comes out of the computer in a sense and enters your actual body, which is the plot of that opera.
Yes, an asymmetrical information. We see things that the characters on stage don't right. see. It's the quintessential element of farce as
right.
well.
And of course, in this case too, we don't really necessarily know that all the different people are just one person until the very end. I mean, of course, one suspects, but to a certain extent, you know, the way to make it theatrical is to have it be unclear who all these people are until the very end. You realize that what this little boy has done, he's actually an opera composer in a sense, right? Because you make up all these different characters. And it's the same thing with Marnie, which is an opera that just premiered last year, which is about a woman who invents all these different identities in order to kind of run from something traumatic in her childhood. Again, she becomes an opera composer.
Who would you say your antecedents in working in opera? I'm thinking Benjamin Britten comes through a lot, and you have a long history of loving English music. I would also say John Adams. And one of the reasons I say John Adams is he is also someone very concerned with bringing what's going on in the world around us onto the stage. It's not looking at Greek gods. It's not looking way back centuries into the mm-hmm. past. It's what's going on in our current moment.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I think you know, John's music is so part of my musical DNA that it would be hard to even pinpoint what's coming from it and what's not. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that is tricky about identifying sort of operatic predecessors is that, you know, all those, the two early Adams operas, which is to say, you know, Klinghoffer and Nixon, and I would also weirdly loop Dr. Atomic in with that, even though chronologically it's not quite right. Those are such perfect expressions of that sort of, this is what's happening, this is the way that we're going to stylize it artistically, that I would never want to try to do exactly that. So Two Boys really resisted, in a sense, doing anything that was too, you know, like those collaborations. But I would say, you know, obviously Britain is incredibly important influence, both musically and psychologically and emotionally for me. And, you know, the Turn of the Screw is very much in the DNA of Two Boys. But I would also say Pelléas and Mélisande is a huge influence, in as much as these operas that I've written don't really have arias per se, and there's a sense of deep enigma that is never answered at the center of them, which I know is something that I think a lot of people find frustrating about those operas, and for the same reason that some people just can't bear Pelléas, whereas, like, I will follow that show around the world. I love it so much.
Well, we're talking about influences on both sides of the Atlantic. The opera premiered on both sides of the Atlantic in London and New York. Let's hear the very opening prologue and scene one from Two Boys. The opening of the acclaimed opera Two Boys by Nico Muhly, the opening prologue and scene one, the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by David Robertson, known to us here in Australia. And you are listening to The Music Show. I'm Julian Day. Nico Muhly is sitting opposite me. I think I read that when you were commissioned for this, you were the youngest composer in the Met's history to write an opera for them. I guess in classical music terms, it's not hard to be that, because, you know, age is a very relative right. thing.
And yeah, it's, you know, for better or for worse, it's a true statement, but I don't ascribe too much value to it.
Nonetheless, does that kind of put a lot of pressure on you? What does it feel like when you get a big commission like that?
Any commission, it doesn't matter if it's a 4-minute piece for choir or a 2-hour piece for a huge opera. I mean, a commission is a challenge, right? And a commission is not, yay, I got a commission. A commission is, oh my God, I have to climb a mountain of this dimension. And so to a certain extent, you know, of course it's thrilling, but it was also terrifying. And it was also, you know, thinking about what it is that I have to say that requires those forces, right? Like, why is it not just a song cycle? Why is it not a chamber opera? So yeah, it was thrilling and terrifying, like so much of one's life.
Well, how thrilling and how terrifying was this new work for the Omega Ensemble? That's one of the things that's brought you here to Australia. There's also this other big Gondwana opening gala, Sounds of Australia. Tell us about this, the piece for Omega, maybe firstly. It's a setting of an Egyptian poet, Gavafi, who you've said a few times.
Yeah, He was writing in Greek, and his poems have been translated in full by Daniel Mendelssohn, who's a fantastic scholar and was teaching at Columbia when I was there. So we have this sort of personal connection. And I was just so struck by, the beauty of these poems and the strange subtlety and these moments of really sharp acuity. And I've set maybe 7 or 8 of them in the last couple of years. So strangely, when this commission came about, the commissioners proposed that I set this text, and they didn't know that I had set so much Gavafi because none of those pieces are recorded. So I thought, well, you know, obviously this is made, you know, it's beshared, like it's exactly what I should be doing. And I realized though that Gavafi, who was an homosexual, always skirts around gayness, rather like in Britain's works, where, you know, the closest it comes is through, you know, suggested an innuendo maybe in Death in Venice. And so this was actually the most explicitly romantic poem of his that I'd set. And so it was actually quite terrifying because I'd never actually done that. You know, I realized when I was doing it, I've never really set a consensual sex scene. There's sort of something like it in Two Boys, but someone's not of the age. So, you know, that's actually really hard. And the question is, because again, it's all happening behind doors and it's all happening with this omniscient narrator. So essentially, the poem is in 3 parts. The beginning, there's a young man who we know is either 23 or 24, and he's waiting for his friend in a cafe. And we have the clear sense of the passage of time. And so the music is sort of appropriately metronomic. And through that waiting period, he starts thinking, what have I done with my life? I've smoked all my cigarettes. I don't have any money. I'm filled with irksome thoughts. And suddenly his friend comes in and all of those thoughts disappear immediately. And there's a sense of sort of shimmer. And then he and his friend reveals that he just won a ton of money gambling. And then they basically spend the rest of the night, you know, drinking and going to a den of vice. And then the last line is that when all the drinks had been drunk, happy, they gave themselves to love. So it's tricky. And it was hard to figure out, but what was great is to have Omega, who are such a wonderful and expressive ensemble, to be able to use the instruments both soloistically and in almost an operatic way and in a sort of piero plus percussion-y way. We'll see. it's all very exciting. But it's, you know, I always get extra butterfly-ish before rehearsing vocal music, because of course the communicative agenda needs to be to the fore, rather than, you know, of course I can fuss with, you know, this clarinet lick should be faster and whatever, but really what we're aiming for is like the communication of the story.
It's so direct. I mean, it's right. Almost naked in a way, hearing the voice convey
exactly
this.
And you can't, there's so many more ways to get it wrong.
Well, I guess seeing you've composed so many Gavafi works, at some point I'm sure we'll have an album of your...
I hope so. Get someone on the phone.
And we're also putting you through your paces this year here in Australia. So a number of Nico Muhly premieres and Australian premieres, including the Australian Chamber Orchestra a little later in the year. So great that you could drop by in your busy schedule.
So happy to be here.
And we hope to speak with you very soon.
Talk to you soon.